I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. You're warned that spoiler alerts abound in this following as we look at the fifth season that was of Mad Men, the morning after its finale. Joining me now is the journalist and musician Paul Myers. He's been on before for his books on Long John Baldry and most recently for his book on Todd Rundgren. He's a thoughtful viewer of the sophisticated AMC drama series set in the world of New York advertising in the 1960s. With his background as a performer and a writer on music, we'll also look at the show's use of music, particularly this season that saw the use of a Beatles record that reportedly cost the show $250,000. His blog is at pullmyears.wordpress.com. That's pullmyears.wordpress.com. Also, he's written a book on the Bare Naked Ladies. And he was a media personality in this city for some time in the last decade. In Berkeley, California, this day, please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Paul Myers. Mr. Myers, good morning.
Hey, Joseph. How are you doing today?
Very good. Yourself?
So let's talk about Mad Men.
Yeah, let's do that then. I read a tweet of yours over the last day or so, the last few hours, that that you were underwhelmed by the finale.
Well, yeah, and I'll flesh that out because I have more than 140 characters here.
Yeah.
So what I was trying to get across in my underwhelmed statement was, I think partly I'm to blame because the episodes are so rich and so full of plot points that when there was no way in the world Matt Weiner could have tied up the show in one episode, and so much had happened with Lane hanging himself in the previous episode and various things that were headed for a seemingly explosive confrontation. I feel like, in a weird way, this was like a literary denouement. You know, this was the big event happened in the last episode before this.
Yeah.
And the finale was merely similar to the idea of crop rotation. He's laying out the field for the next season. He's planting seeds. You know, they're getting the new office. They're getting... There's a motion in Megan's career, but nothing's resolved. Is Don going to cheat again? They gave it a real Sopranos cliffhanger there. It reminded me of the last episode of the Sopranos series, where we just see Don's face. We don't see if he's about to accede to the come on of the woman in the cocktail lounge. So I guess what happened was, I felt like I also didn't believe the Alexis Bledel, what's her name, Beth.
Beth,
the woman who's getting shock treatment. I love her. Like, I think she's a pretty lady, and I think she's an interesting actress, but she didn't deliver the weight that scene needed. Pete was really good in that Vince Kartheiser. He's a really good actor. He had a lot of great lines, but then there's nothing matching him, partly because she'd had shock therapy. But it made for kind of dull, like, dialogue-driven things have to have a little bit of action, and, you know, literally hanging themselves or driving fast cars. Things like that. Anyway, I just felt, and, you know, Pete getting punched out, you know, things happened, but I felt like it wasn't, I felt like it, at the time, my first feeling, my first take when I made that tweet was, I feel like I wanted more, but that could be my fault, too. I'm willing for it to be my fault. Like, I may have expected too much.
Yeah, looking back, most Mad Men episodes, the finales at least, the last episodes of the seasons, as well as The Sopranos, they've been generally low-key. Everything happens in the episode or two before. Is that your observation as well?
That's a good point. Yeah, I guess that's what he does. Maybe that's the the crossfade. Like he wants to create like a something that makes you think, like, you know, typically a cliffhanger, like, and typically you're going to want to be interested in. There's got to be a reason for next season to happen, like a plot point reason for next season to happen. And so there's still so much not resolved. And besides the fact, I think we watch Mad Men to see the history unfold and how it affects human lives. Because that's, you know, as anyone, I think someone who writes scripts told me once that premise and character are like big lures to someone watching something, but the story and the human interaction of the characters and the conflicts of the characters, that's what keeps you coming back.
Yeah.
So the premise of an ad person in the late 60s is going to be tasty and visual, but it's not going to be enough unless we care what happens to these people. And I guess Don we still care about. And I sort of care about what happens to Megan, too, because I felt like at the end of that episode, Don had given Megan happiness and couldn't deal with that. And he walked away literally into the darkness as Megan's shooting the commercial. And he walked away and then immediately went to a singles, well, not a singles bar, but a cocktail bar and acted like he was a loner, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there's all that, in the music, there's a lot of cues like, you know, oh, what was last night's song?
You Only Live Twice.
You Only Live Twice, which, I mean, such an homage to his double life and, you know, and just, like, everyone, a lot of people have double lives on Mad Men. A lot of people have a world that they tell everyone and a world that they're really living, you know? And Don has several.
Yeah.
But, you know, Megan even lied to her friend. Like,
about
the
commercial, yeah.
Yeah, her friend, oh, yeah, I'm assuming everyone who's listening to this has seen the show. I hope that has, if not, you should listen to it after you've seen the show.
Yeah, exactly.
So her friend asks her to get the gig and even says, you know, can you get me an audition? It's really good for a foreign person or a European accent. And, of course, she's from Quebec, so that passes for a European accent. You know, and so, in America, that is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she boldface lies in a moment of kind of cheating ambition. And, again, it's maybe a small lie in the scheme of lies on that show. Also, they don't like, just on another tack, they don't like Joan in the office because Joan's twice the Lane that Lane was. Joan's saying, we got to watch our balances, we got to watch our books, and she's, like, totally on top of the meeting, and they're all freaking out, too, because it's a woman.
Yeah.
And secondly, and I also wonder if Joan's fighting twice as hard because everyone in that room knows how she got the gig.
Yeah.
She slept with someone to exchange for a controlling interest in the company. And, like, that's always going to be a thorn in her side or a shadow on her. You know, Pete doesn't expect her.
Yeah, do you, now that the show's finished for the season, and I don't know how long we'll wait till the next season, do you wonder what'll happen? I mean, is that a waste of time for people on the internet to wonder, did Don cheat on Megan at the bar? What happens to Pete and all that? Does he get the apartment?
What's interesting about that question, Joseph, is that the sad truth of being a fan of the show is he doesn't always explain everything, and sometimes entire, like the whole Dawn, D-A-W-N, the African-American receptionist,
yep.
That whole plot started out to be at the beginning of the season. We thought this whole season was going to be about, or I did,
about
I thought
race.
The whole season was going to be about the civil rights revolution in the late mid-60s. I thought we were going to have the Jewish writer Ginsburg represent the, you know, the breaking of the Gentile wall, and Dawn, the receptionist, is going to represent the breaking of the color bar.
Yeah.
But instead, you know, we have one reference to her at the end of the show when he calls, when the client calls her black coffee over there, which was laughable racism, if there's such a thing,
mm-hmm.
In that it was almost innocuous, you know, it certainly wasn't the N-word, mm-hmm. but it's the kind of insidious racism and sexism that persists even today amongst certain races, you know,
mm-hmm.
like most racism is veiled in our society, right? Because everyone knows not to be overtly racist unless you're, you know, frankly, a Tea Party candidate or something in the USA. But that's just my little editorial.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, but it was interesting that they misdirected you with that whole thing. Like, there was almost no reference to race and or Dawn, the receptionist, all year. And Ginsburg, again, they just show him being disgruntled. He looked great, by the way. He looked like a young, handsome, go-for-it kind of guy who wasn't going to take any crap anymore. And that's a good conflict for next season, again, with the planting of things. Like, I feel like there's going to be a head-off between Ginsburg and Draper, something to do with, I'm the man you think you are, you know, and I'm more of the creative genius. There's a line that, oh, sorry, I'm blurting now, but Megan's mother said some of the most devastating lines last night, like, in telling...
In French, though.
Megan that she's not an artist.
Yeah.
She's, you know, and then, like, I was thinking that kind of applies to Don feeling threatened that he's been a creative genius, but he's not that creative. Like, Megan was his secret weapon early in the season. Ginsburg's his secret weapon. He has, and Peggy's gone. So all the people that really made him look good leave him.
Yeah.
You know?
the other thing that I found interesting, you mentioned all the lines that Megan's mom had, they were all in French. And I can't think of a show, another show on television that could do that as well as Mad Men did.
Yeah, and they use it to great effect. Whenever people want to speak and exclude people, they can speak in the code, which is French, you know. And but even then, she couldn't, like, the mother had to make an excuse to have her leave the room so that she could talk to Roger, you know.
Yeah.
I love that Roger wants to get back into LSD. And I think Roger's been the most delightful character this season, even though he's still a misanthrope and he's still a womanizer and all those things, but he's kind of a womanizer who's womanizing the same way people use experimental drugs. I feel like he's using sex as a way to find something, the way that, you know, Timothy Leary might have been using LSD, you know?
Yeah.
And just that he wants to go back, he wants to get a re-up on his LSD experience, because he was getting enlightened, and then, as he said, I think in the episode before, he goes, it wore off.
Yeah.
You know? So now he wants to go back to LSD land, you know, because he's looking for he might end up being a really interesting character next year, too, right?
Yeah.
Like, Roger might grow his hair long and start wearing African clothes, you know, that's what I'm thinking. Like, or sideburns, at least. Like,
yeah.
I'm expecting something like a dashiki next season, you know, like those African smocks that everyone wore in the 60s.
He had
like the year that the Brady Bunch, all had perm suddenly.
Uh huh. Yeah. He had a great line last night when I guess Megan's mom was talking in French, and he goes, "What's Regina?"
Yes.
Yeah, which I thought was kind of clever, because she was asking the question in French, and so I guess he has some sort of understanding of it that he could pick out that she used the word Regina.
Yeah, yeah. It showed that he was listening, but not understanding, and just picked out a key word and sort of felt like, I wondered if he thought it sounded like vagina, but I don't, I think that's just a little too much, you know, in that he would be so centered on that, but, I wondered about that too. I thought it was very realistic. It was very weird when Pete got thrown off the track. I feel really bad for Trudy. I feel like Trudy's a really, really, she's a pretty nice lady,
mm-hmm.
and she's a homemaker, and she just wants the best, and she's a nice lady, and Pete's just uncomfortable and unhappy all the time, and it's not enough for him, and, you know, and she's got the drawings of the new pool, and she's even drawn them in as a happy family, which only tortures Pete even more, you know. He had a great line about, temporary bandage for a permanent wound?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like, there was some crazy speechifying there. Like, he almost too much if you think about it. Like, characters in real life don't always speak in complete paragraphs.
No.
But I guess if you're in the ad business,
you would, yeah. I mean, even the line about the kid drowning in the pool, I thought that was really clever. Because, I mean, that ended the scene. I mean, that was the only way that they could have ended that scene, right?
He just saw the potential disaster of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the baby starts crying, and then she has to leave the room, and then he just sits there alone drinking. When you watch this show, because of your background in music and the sort, do you listen for the songs that Weiner chooses to put in?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
I have another friend. I have another friend, Justin Smallbridge, who's from the broadcasting community originally in Vancouver now. He always posts articles of the top 10 that was the top 10 the week, like, you know, the WABC top 10 of the week that the show air was supposed to be in, you know.
Uh-huh.
What do I think about that music? Oh, I thought, okay, I laughed and cried when Roger took LSD the first time, and there was I Just Wasn't Made for These Times by the Beach Boys, because it would have been a little too easy to use God Only Knows or Wouldn't It Be Nice from the Pet Sounds album. But as a musician, I know that one of the core songs on Pet Sounds, which musicians will tell you, the Beach Boys Pet Sounds album from 1966, changed the rules. It was one of those rule changes. Even the Beatles, like, loved that record. And so when he has I Just Wasn't Made for These Times playing, it's melancholy, it's slightly psychedelic, but it's questioning where you fit in the world. So an older man taking LSD and a song that expresses profound melancholy and loneliness at the same time, and of course we all know that, maybe we don't all know, but for guys like me, the added bonus is Brian Wilson was on that voyage also. He was working with Ad Men. Like, I don't know if you know this, but the lyrics to I think Pet Sounds, if I'm not mistaken, it was written by an ad man. Like, there was an ad man who wrote songs, and Brian Wilson didn't know how to write lyrics or didn't feel like he could, but he knew how to make really great music, so he would tell this ad man what he was thinking, and this ad man would come up with these great lyrics. So all those lyrics on Pet Sounds were written by a person whose job it was to put things into words. And that's kind of an interesting, you know, considering it's Mad Men, mm-hmm. It's an interesting subtext that I don't think anyone's actually, I just thought of it now, actually. Don't think I've ever read that anywhere. But so when they used that song, it was like, oh my God, this is where the show, like, I think I said yes out loud, and my wife went, what? And I had to explain that.
Yeah.
And also when he used Tomorrow Never Knows, which you mentioned earlier is the most expensive, probably one of the most expensive, how many seconds was that? I think they used a lot of it. They had to come back as well because they paid for it. They might as well have it be on the outro as well.
Yeah.
But Tomorrow Never Knows is another great subtext lyric, as well as it's the Beatles' first time they had gone, because that was from Revolver, and Revolver was that album that after Rubber Soul, they'd gotten serious from being a teen pop band to kind of a Dylan-y inspired, like, serious band, and kind of created that whole album seriousness thing that we now take for granted. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow Never Knows is from Revolver, where they really started to push the studio, and they really started, and they've been smoking dope and all these things. So they were on a voyage of consciousness and technical experimentation, and so to have Tomorrow Never Knows, which lyrically is about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it's about the uncertainty of the future. I mean, it's literally about the uncertainty of the future. And that's perfect for a show where the characters are slightly out of control as modernity catches up to their staid middle-class 50s life. You know, they used to be the kings of this stuff, and now they don't understand. You know, it's like, that's what makes the show wonderful for me. It's really displaying the crunch, you know? Obviously, full disclosure, my brother created Austin Powers. Austin Powers was kind of about this in a comic way. Austin Powers was about what if a 60s character had to deal with the 90s, or I think it was the 80s and the 90s, and had to be sort of caught up from the sexual revolution, the drug revolution, and the consequences of that kind of licentious attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so what made Austin Powers sort of funny was that it was this swinging character who was a happy-go-lucky guy suddenly having to deal with heavy reality, social commitment, and does his reputation give him his power? You know, so Don Draper in that way is the same kind of guy. You know, but anyway, go ahead.
To move on to other music that we've heard in this season, the use of Burt Bacharach. I know that you tweeted about he and Hal David received an award recently at the White House, which I guess your brother was at. That music, the poppy sort of music of the 1960s. What do you make of how its use in the Mad Men, as well as just how it's sort of had this revival, if I can call it that, in recent years.
What's the question?
Well, I'm just wondering, like, the music that Burt Bacharach music, it went out of vogue in the 70s, I guess, didn't it? I mean, you'll know more about this than I would. I mean,
Burt Bacharach, I guess the 70s. Well, actually, the 70s were still a good time for Burt because the Carpenters.
Yeah, and Dionne Warwick, and I guess, you know.
Yeah, the Carpenters also had the hit with "Close to You," which was a Burt Bacharach song and Hal David song. And that, you know, that was a popular sound. It wasn't hip, though.
Yeah.
It was, so they had a lot of popularity, but they'd become the old guard, and they represented the sort of white shoes, boating attire kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, it was Beverly Hills. Yeah, it was sort of the music that would be on, like, say, Lawrence Welk in the era, right?
Yeah, you'd picture it being at Don Rickles or Buddy Hackett's house. They would have a Burt Bacharach record as their swingin' music.
Yeah.
You know, it would be their, we're going to play some young people music now, it would be Burt Bacharach, you know. But the thing is, musicians and songwriters, from Brian Wilson to a lot of people, have always known, at least the music of Burt Bacharach. Lyrically, he'd kind of, Hal David's lyrics, I always argue, some of them are particularly dated, like Wives and Lovers, where the line is, hey, little girl with your hair in the curlers, time to get ready for love. And it's basically telling the story of a housewife better clean up
Trudy.
Before the husband comes home from work.
Yeah, you know? Trudy or Betty, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Megan, too, who's, like my wife noted last night, Megan's still not wearing shoes in the house, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so she won't be that wife. She's not going to be that wife. She's not domesticated. She's still a wild animal. She's questioning her power, and she makes a sexual advance on Dawn last night. But, I mean, I wonder what the toothache was all about. Was the toothache, I mean, I thought the
yeah.
brother was heavy-handed. The brother with the new
around
his
neck. Seeing him in the elevator and then seeing him in the office.
The brother, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was heavy-handed. I thought, I understand it because Lane killed himself in the same way, and they have to at least represent that Don going through a period of questioning whether he drove Lane to suicide like he drives everyone. But I felt like the way they did it, like that rotting tooth, maybe it's your soul. Like that's like, oh my God, you know, seriously,
yeah.
weigh that thing, it's probably over the limit. You know,
are there
as hands go, it was pretty heavy-handed.
Are you? Do you watch other shows as closely as you watch Mad Men?
Well, here's a funny thing. I was going to share with you. The minute you asked me to do this, I said, "What's interesting is, I now watch other shows, and I do the same analysis of the plot points because I think I watched The Wire and The Sopranos this way.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would after every Sopranos, to some extent, Deadwood. I think it's an HBO thing, generally.
Yeah.
But what's been happening is, since Mad Men, since the Twitter and Facebook experience of watching a show, which means you have a group think after the show, or you get a chance to be exposed to the, you know, crowdsourcing, the group mind, like, there's instant forums available that you used to have to go seek out chat rooms to get that kind of stuff, and now it's just there. Spoiler alerts and all.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. The spoiler alert thing has made me not time shift Mad Men the way I would other shows. Because I can't stand, I get, you might have seen on Twitter,
yeah.
I get panicked if I'm in a hotel room. Twice I've had terrible hotel TVs, and I get as angry about it as though there was no towels. Like, I mean,
yeah.
And it's embarrassing perhaps, but I think if you're a Mad Men obsessive, you kind of know, like, it's powerless. Like, I'm recording it at home usually, so when I get home, I know I can watch it. But that's 3 days late.
Yeah.
You know, like so. But anyway, what's happened is I watch other shows like Girls now on HBO, and I watch Veep.
Yeah.
And I love them both, and they're not the same kind of show. They're certainly not as I don't know if they're not as deep, but they're just not as detailed. You know. But I will say this: I watched them and I followed. Like, I don't know if you're watching Girls. Are you watching Girls?
I watched the pilot. That's the only thing I've seen of Girls.
Oh, you know what? I thought the pilot was good, and the second one I didn't like. The second episode.
Yeah.
I think the third one I was thinking I'm going to give up. For some reason, I watched the fourth one and everything kicked in.
Hmm.
And
okay.
This is one of those shows that I felt like actually Judd Apatow came back and wrote an episode
mm-hmm.
or co-wrote an episode, and I think he brought something to it that might have been missing. And maybe that's why he did the fourth episode. I'm not sure if it was the fourth, by the way, if you're listening and you know the numbers of the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a late mid-season episode. And from that point on, they did this thing where Hannah and her weird boyfriend, Adam, they'd gone through this abusive relationship that was back and forth, and Hannah's Lena Dunham. And anyway, so in the last two or three episodes, the Hannah-Adam dynamic has been so interesting, like truly worthy of discussion. And I feel like the reason I noticed this stuff, though, is because I usually watch it the same night I watch Mad Men.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm getting to, which is Mad Men has made me, I don't know about you, but like when I go to what's the guy who made Tree of Life? Terrence
Malick.
Malick.
Yeah.
When I go to a Terrence Malick film, I'm usually like, studying it while I'm watching it, and I'm usually trying to find what's supposed to be there and watching the frames and watching the way the cinematography's set up and watching the way the words are. And I end up leaving the cinema, walking down the street and seeing things a different way because my brain is now actively analyzing scenes.
Yeah.
And I think Mad Men does that for regular TV shows for me. I think it creates that need to feel like there's some meaning in everything you're looking at.
Yeah. Now, how does it? I mean, the show's not finished yet. I mean, there's at least two more seasons left to go. How does it rank, though, in terms of the, in the history of television? I mean, is it one of those great shows? There, is it up there with The Sopranos? Say.
It's early to tell. My feeling is that it has become that in the last two seasons.
Yeah.
I have to say, the first season, I watched the first season, and I didn't tune in every episode. I stopped watching season one. I stopped watching episode four, and then I didn't watch the rest of the season until later. I've watched it since.
Yeah.
And then season two, we were all sitting around one day, and I said, sort of liked it. I'll watch this season and start again. And then I liked it, and then it got interesting, and then by the end of season two, I was hooked. Season three, I think it started to really peak, and I feel like it has peaked, and now the challenge for him is to not have it go back down. And this season had a few moments where I felt like they were repeating themselves, or it became melodrama for melodrama's sake, or they'd lost some of the historical anachronism that made it fun. They kind of got sidetracked by, glitter and glitz and stuff. But they're doing a good job. I think he's probably doing one of the... And when I hear about the drama behind the scenes, I'm surprised he even got this season on, frankly.
Yeah.
And who knows what'll happen next. And I think it is. I think it might be. I actually thought Deadwood was one of the great series, and it got canceled before it was finished. So Deadwood's another show that if you know it and love it, you know exactly what I mean. Like, there's a rhythm and poetry to Deadwood that... I don't watch Westerns generally.
Yeah.
Like, I won't say blanketly that I don't like Westerns, because I've liked some, like Unforgiven and True Grit. But generally, I'm not drawn to the Western genre. But this Deadwood felt like a totally original take on the whole gold mining town thing. Maybe because I live in California now, and I've been through those towns, the so-called Deadwood towns.
Mm-hmm.
Like, on the way to Yosemite, you go through these towns that are former gold mines, and it seems like they really brought it to life in a way that I hadn't seen before. And again, it was characters and stories made it real. Like Calamity Jane being an alcoholic, possibly lesbian woman, not really frustrated on every level of her life. And usually Calamity Jane was depicted as a gun-toting badass, mm-hmm. But instead you felt like she was a pathetic street woman who got violent because she had she had problems.
Yeah. Paul, you're...
Anyway, I digress. I'm not here to talk about Deadwood, but yeah.
You're good to do this. I appreciate this, and I'm shuddering to think now what we'll do on Sunday nights.
Yeah, the newsroom's starting up.
New Aaron Sorkin show, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that could be an awesome... That could be... that. You know what that is? That's Aaron Sorkin doing The West Wing to Network, to Sidney Lumet's Network. So I want you to watch that, and I'll watch that, and maybe we'll come back and talk about that sometime.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah.
Pullmyears.blogspot.com is Paul's website. He's online from Berkeley in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.